Welcome, everyone, to this very special edition podcast series on the 2020 Bitcoin halving, brought to you by our friends at Bitstamp, the original global cryptocurrency exchange. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors everywhere, trusted by over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools available on web and mobile. Join 4 million traders and download the Bitstamp app from the App Store or Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro. And for Bitstamp users, we've got a special. Ansari is now offering 25% off Ansari Pro, our professional-grade crypto analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help you identify your next investments. Head over to Ansari.io and use the offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. That's Ansari.io, offer code Bitstamp. With that, let's dive right in. This episode's going to be a good one. All right, everyone, welcome back to this special episode of Ansari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2BitIdiots. I have a very special guest today to talk about the Bitcoin halving. He's been through two of them already, and this will be a third. I'm talking about Charlie Schrem, one of the OGs in the Bitcoin industry I've known for a long time. He's had a very colorful history and an even more colorful shirt, which we're very disappointed. Somehow, the Zoom filters were making this blue shirt of his, if you're watching, turn into a camo rainforesty type of montage. And then I think the light just worked against us. So it might be coming in and out as you're watching this conversation. But it's fitting because you certainly are one of crypto's most colorful OGs. And so Charlie, I think, you know, most people probably know who you are, or at least they know the headline version. But I want to start the conversation just by going back, like way back, and talk about the early days of Bitcoin and in particular, maybe that first halving. But for the few that don't know the backstory of BitInstant and kind of the very, very early Bitcoin crowd, why don't you just fill everybody in on your background, how you got started, and we could talk about some of the early days pre-halving 1.0.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm really happy to be here on the show. And our personal histories have interwoven like so many times. But what's interesting about the halving and like my own personal story is, like you said, I've been through three halvings. But now I'm at that point now going into, as we were going into 2020 and now going into 2021 eventually, where I'm going through my own personal decade in Bitcoin. And so I'm saying to myself, what have I done in the past 10 years? What do I want to look forward like personally, like Charlie Schrem over the next 10 years in Bitcoin? So it's almost like I'm having my own halving coming up in the next like year or so.
Mm-hmm. We can talk about what's next and how you're thinking about your own personal halving. But you started in 2010, late 2010, right? Early 2011.
Yeah. It was around that time.
Yep. So talk a little bit about your discovery and that early year and a half or so when Bitcoin A was still a science experiment, B was very early on in the life cycle of just the creation of the currency and the availability of these different units of currency.
It's so interesting because we talk about like the years. Back then, no one really cared what year or even month or day you got involved. In fact, I know a lot of people, myself included, who almost wish we created like our forum accounts a little bit earlier so we could be a little bit more OG, you know? I wish I made my forum account in 2010 and I just was a lurker for so many months. I just, you know, most people, when do you create a forum account? When you want to post something, right? So a lot of people are looking for their, and you're seeing it more and more, looking for their, like, when they first got involved, their first, like, when they first tweeted about Bitcoin and everything like that. But those early years, and I'll use Bitcoin now, and then eventually I'll try to do it in a way with integrity of, like, Bitcoin, then there was, like, altcoins and Ethereum, and then there was the larger crypto space now. So I try to use them as accurately as possible, although I don't do my best job like I'll confuse Bitcoin with crypto or whatever, whatever, but I don't want anyone to think like differently. So Bitcoin in the early days, was very kind of an online only place. So for the first year, everything was online. It was all chat rooms. It was mostly, through Bitcoin Talk forums, which wasn't Bitcoin Talk. It was forum.bitcoin.org, which was the site that Satoshi created, forums that he created along with, Marti Amalmi and Sirius. And that was where everyone was. Eventually you would see, so that was the official, the forums that was moderated, and then the unmoderated chats and conversations and like company announcements were happening on IRC, the internet relay chat. In mm-hmm. fact, I think Bitcoin developer meetings are still happening on like the IRC. Are they? I'm pretty sure Luke told me they're still happening there. So, it's kind of crazy how, like where we've come since then, but that's where everyone got started. And in fact, you couldn't launch a company if you didn't make an announcement on Bitcoin Talk forums on or forum.bitcoin.org on the Bitcoin forums. You couldn't. Coinbase launched, BitInstant launched, Bittrex launched. Every OG company today launched on, Mt. Gox even launched on the Bitcoin Talk forums, right? Everyone launched on Bitcoin Talk, and that was like almost a rite of passage. Because what'll happen is, and this is actually, it's funny to bring this up, I've never really talked about this before. What would happen is someone would say, hey, did you check out this company? Or what is this company reputable? You would look at their forum post, and it didn't really matter. Like you had a company that had 167 pages, you know that the forum is ripping that company to shreds and that company's responding and it's going. So talk about transparency and disclosures that you and I have talked about. That's what it was back then. You'd have all the, so you had a company that would launch and have one page, and it would be all the company just like posting announcements. Okay, this company's not really. And in fact, that's how ICOs were judged back when the first ICOs were launched in coins, were how many pages, like what's the community like? And then you would actually look, there were some people that were members of the community, I don't want to name them, that were members of the forums that were like legendary members. And you'd almost look and say, why didn't this guy comment on that token or that project or that coin? I'm talking about like 2014, right? And so that was the early Bitcoin community.
You just give people a sense for how many people were in the forum at that point. You called yourself a lurker in 2010, but you know, 2010, 2011,
a few hundred people, maybe.
Yeah. I've also found it interesting, like the platform graduations that people have made, right? So at first it was Bitcoin Talk. Then it was our Bitcoin. And then it was probably Twitter. Right, the three life cycles so far, and I'm curious if there's going to be another platform sea change in the coming years, particularly with some of the censorship that's going on the major, you know, social media platforms and just how toxic crypto Twitter is right now.
Do you think people left crypto Reddit for crypto Twitter because of issues with crypto Reddit, or did people leave crypto Reddit for crypto Twitter just because Twitter was like the next evolution of? Because that answers your question. Are people going to leave because of like a natural evolution, or will people, and people in the crypto community, will they more of like a natural progression to something else?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the toxicity, and particularly around like the Bitcoin halving and around, the fact that Ethereum launched and, you know, there was a bifurcation of the conversation between, what you'd see on our Bitcoin and our Ethereum and some of the other subreddits. So, Twitter was just more interoperable that way. But, you know, Bitcoin.
I'm trying to remember what I did on the last halving. I'm like juggling my mind and it's bothering me. I remember two halvings ago, but I don't remember the last halving.
Well, we can get to the second halving. And for those watching, the camo is back in full effect, which is exciting. For the first halving, this is late 2012, so you're running BitInstant at the time. What were some of the considerations that you had, if any, in terms of technical concerns, or you know, was this a marketing event for you? Did it really move the needle one way or the other?
Oh my God!
How did you guys think about the first
halving? I love talking about this. The halving for me and like my little crypto friend group is a huge. Huge, huge, big deal for us because in the beginning it was almost seen as a Y2K moment. Worse. Mm-hmm. Because, dude, you're talking about like, first of all, the Bitcoin code base it was so small at that point and still is, you know, for what it is. I mean, if you compare what Bitcoin does with what like Visa or MasterCard does or any other you know, banking software. You look at like the core Bitcoin code base, it's so small compared to like what, you know, to these other ones. But, you know, you look at this and here's a section of code that's never been used before, or it'd be used like once. So as the halvings go on, this section of code is being used obviously every 4 years more and more. So there's a little bit more of like a known, you know, there's like, we know that it's going to be okay. But back in 2012, during that first halving, there was a huge fear of, is this going to work? Will the mechanism that switches the block reward, you know, because you're talking about, there's no gray area. It's a very quick switch. It goes from one block is 25 Bitcoin and then, or 50 Bitcoin, and the next block is 25 Bitcoin. So it's a huge shift. So you're talking about a section. The fear was, at least for me and for a lot of people, was, are new miners going to accept the new blocks? Is the software going to say, whoa, we're looking for 50 Bitcoin rewards. You know, the Coinbase, it's all built into the Coinbase, right? Not the company Coinbase, for those listening. That was actually taken after, you know, you have a part of the transaction on Bitcoin, not to get too much into the reads, includes a Coinbase of a newly mined block. So what happens there? And that was a huge fear. So it wasn't the parties of the day. There was no cakes. It was more like sitting at our computers in IRC hoping Bitcoin doesn't die. That was the first halving for me. And there was a celebration, don't get me wrong. But it wasn't about price appreciation. Price appreciation, because no one really talked about price appreciation, right? We were just lucky that Bitcoin was alive and up from the price of the day before, right? Mm-hmm. We all saw day jobs. We all had regular jobs. Tony Gallippi, the founder of BitPay, was a photographer. You know, I was working, I forgot where I was working. Everyone had like different real jobs. You had a real job. Everyone had real jobs. And so that was that first halving. The second halving, in 2016, like I forget where I was, but I do remember it was more celebratory. It was less, is this going to work? Although I have to admit, I did psych people out a lot. I would like hype people up and like, listen, I don't know if the halving is going to work or not. You know, it could break Bitcoin, and people would get, you know, my friends, but they knew I was joking. So it was more celebratory on that front. I remember we got a cake. Luke Desheer was there, or maybe that was our SegWit party. We had a SegWit party too with a SegWit cake.
I think I know where you were for the second halving. So maybe that's why it all blends together.
Oh no, wait, I was with you for the second halving. I was with you for the second halving, wasn't I, in New York doing that event?
I think that you were just, it was somewhere around then, because it was the summer of 2016 and you'd just gotten out, right?
Yeah, I had just gotten out and it was the first halving, and I remember like we were talking in one of the first events that I did. So it may have been around that time, like May or June of 2016, we have to look it up because we were celebrating something or you're doing like a whole CoinDesk speaker series. But that AMA that I did, that you ran, that I did with Pete Rizzo, was like one of my first times. And I was nervous that I would be a little bit weird. And I feel like I was a little bit. But so that was that, you know, the 2016 halving. Let me ask you a question. What do you feel about the sentiment around that halving versus the sentiment around this halving? And how did COVID like throw a ringer in all of that, do you think?
I actually think that the two are very similar. I think both were overhyped and both served as life rafts of sorts for people that were kind of grasping it at, you know, the Bitcoin narrative in a macro context. And, you know, slightly different because the backdrop's different. But in 2015, 2016, we were coming off really a Bitcoin depression. And a lot of the biggest companies that people know today, you know, many of them were on life support after, you know, a prolonged period in the 200s. Yeah. In 2015 and kind of a venture capital environment that had mostly dried up and just a series of headwinds that, you know, did not make Bitcoin's future success, certainly not the infrastructure, a foregone conclusion. And I think the 2016 rally leading up to the halving and kind of the rally around, you know, our first consensus conference at CoinDesk that spring in New York, both I think helped rally spirits and morale and, you know, people were able to look at this as a catalyst for picking up the macro conversation around Bitcoin as a digital gold and store of value. And the fact that, it, you know, at that time, the inflation rate, you know, at that halving dropped into the low or mid single digits.
Your,
I think
your first important. Consensus was in 2016, right? Or 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was right before the second halving, right?
I went to the second consensus, I believe. And that was around this time of SegWit 2x. Not before that, but it was around that time.
I'm trying to get the dates right.
The New York. So I don't think I was at the first one, but I distinctly, because I was looking at the charts the other day, I distinctly remember like the all-time high didn't happen until at least a year and a half after that halving. Mm-hmm. But also around the time of the halving, there wasn't much price movement. Like the price was still low. The difference was, we went through this $200 like prolonged headwind depression, like you said, and then pre-halving, we started sitting around $500-$600, and there was no. And I remember this because when I went into jail, the prison price was around $200, and when I got out, the price was around $400-$500. And I was so happy because it was like double that when I went in, like 16 or 17 Bitcoin or whatever it was, you know, not much. I remember so there was that, and it was. They were on the first halving. There wasn't much of a crazy price appreciation at all. It was like it was more solemn. But I remember after that halving is when the miners started dying. And once the miners started, some miners started capitulating after the halving, not before. That's when we started to see that bullish momentum really start to turn. So like I always, a lot of friends are calling me around this time. I'm like, don't trade the halving. It's the worst time to trade. This is the time when whales are going to trade knowing that you're trading and they're going to wreck you. So unless you're a whale, it's not a good time to trade the halving. Never a good time to trade the halving.
Yep. That was true and false. But the sample size is so small that you can't necessarily read causation into the correlation of the halvings. Dan Matuszewski, who was on a previous interview related to the halving, kind of called it out. Bitcoin's pretty much been on a straight shot up since it was created. So, you know, of course the halvings are going to look bullish, but really it's more about the narrative of, you know, Bitcoin's hardness as money.
But every chart looks like, every chart can look like, you know, and like the zero hedge thing, it says like, you know, at any length of time, every chart will go to zero or whatever it is. The same can be said in the same span of time, every chart can look like it's going up. You can look at any chart and, you know, control the time frames. But you're right. Bitcoin, listen, I'll say it right now. Bitcoin is built to appreciate, or you know, I feel it'll have to die if it doesn't continue to appreciate. Now, obviously not as fast. It can continue to appreciate slowly over time, like we saw over years. But the value of Bitcoin, at least the value of Bitcoin to other things, has to continue appreciating. But why do you think, you know, you're an economist. Why do you think that Satoshi did a halving instead of,
I'm not an economist. Go on.
Yeah, but you're a good analyst and you're good at reading charts and things like that. Why? I mean, you run Messari. It's a data company. So you're a data scientist. You're a crypto data scientist. Why do you think Satoshi created that 4-year thing instead of just like making it more of like a real time halving? What, like a real time inflation rate where it's like
the exponential decay?
Yeah.
And I think this is something. It may be just a fortunate accident of history. Mike Hearn actually wrote about this as well, right? In terms of, you know, would it have been ideal to have an exponential decay instead of this kind of artificial construct around the halving? And ultimately, you know, that might have allowed you to have this perpetual low inflation that Bitcoin triangulated on instead of just the actual hard cap of 21 million. Maybe we can get into this after I answer your question, but it remains to be seen whether perpetual low inflation would be ideal versus transitioning to a fee market. That can be part two. Part one, though, I think it's a happy accident of history because it does create these natural narrative cycles in Bitcoin's evolution.
Yeah.
And I've compared it to events, actually, right? So the very best sales days that you have when you're promoting an event, the day you launch, the door, and the announcements that you make along the way on major headline speakers, but more importantly, price hikes, right? everybody piles in before a price hike so that they know I'm planning on purchasing a ticket anyway. I have 3 days to check this off my to-do list before the price goes up by, you know, $100 or $500 or whatever it is. And I think that those flag dates create a little bit of that narrative momentum where people think about their purchases in advance or their trading activity well in advance. And they try to ascertain, you know, when they're going to be able to get a step ahead of the market.
Yeah.
So the halving matters less in terms of dollars and cents and more from a narrative cycle, because you know Bitcoin search activity is going to spike. You know, everybody's going to be talking about Bitcoin and about the halving and the fact that it is harder money and it's less inflationary than all other alternatives and blah, 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 blah. So you know that the increased attention, just like any marketing funnel, is going to lead to higher conversions than steady state. And you're going to have a spike of activity, you know, around this event. So you might as well get a jump on it. And by the way, that creates this kind of virtuous cycle, you know, on the way up and in particular post-halving. And I think, you know, there's kind of the efficient markets hypothesis camp where all this information has been known from day one. So it should be priced in. But then there's the, I think, underappreciated meme factor of halvings, where we wouldn't have gotten that benefit and that kind of narrative cycle if we just had an exponential decay. There wouldn't be a 4-year celebration. There wouldn't be these, you know, crazy charts that, you know, people pull out of their ass.
There wouldn't be much Bitcoin anymore, or crypto in general.
Yeah.
The only difference is, not the only difference, I think that it's a mixture of everything you said. It's not one thing here. There's definitely like, because I'll be, you know, you look at, you're a data scientist, you look at metrics. I look at metrics too, but I look at also like weird metrics. Like, for example, I'm looking at charts that show me how many times the word Bitcoin is mentioned on 4chan every day. Like charts like that, you know, because the meme factor and the hype factor is definitely a part of it. But it's also, I look at these people, the memers, these are the retail people. These are the ones that are like buying, selling, using Bitcoin, spending it with their friends, or just speculating on it, or they're not spending it, or overall crypto. So it's almost like a little bit of a sentiment analysis. But I completely agree with you on almost everything you said. The only thing I won't agree is that it's a one thing. I think it's a mixture of everything. Like, markets are efficient, to a perfect example. So maybe I am in that hypothesis camp that believes that everything is priced in. But I also know the end of that quote, right? Markets are efficient. The end of the quote says, when we allow them to be. And so we obviously don't allow them to be like 100%. We're not 100% free market. So there are things that are manipulated for sure. There are things that are affecting other, you know, that are affecting the markets. Narratives. Dude, our whole industry is one big narrative. Like, everything we started in 2010 with a narrative. 2009. The first line of the Bitcoin, the first, you know, Genesis blog, it's all narratives. That's the whole thing. Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. It's all a narrative. And so, yeah, welcome to Bitcoin.
I want to talk about one. It's not necessarily fully aligned with the halving, but the first halving is end of 2012, 2013. There's this epic rally. You're on top of the world. I remember distinctly that I was going to see you at Miami for the Bitcoin conference. And it turns out that doesn't happen, right? This is mid-January of 2014. You're basically intercepted at the port of entry in New York when you should have been on your way down to Miami for a keynote. And we ended up meeting for the first time a couple weeks later when I was in New York for the BitLicense hearings and you were under house arrest. But between that kind of cooling off period where you're on trial, you ultimately enter the plea and then you do, you know, time in prison, it basically follows the entire bear market decline. And then
it's freaky.
You get out like right before the next halving. So what was that time warp like? Because you left and Mt. Gox imploded. And then you come back and all of a sudden, like you basically, if you're going to miss some time in the industry, I guess you timed it pretty well because you missed the entire bear market.
And like not the entire. The only way I could
most of it,
better,
most of it. Yeah.
Was it the only, because I got arrested at like the height, so like $900 or whatever, but I still had that. I still had to live off of Bitcoin mostly for the first year until I actually went in. So it was like the perfect hold, but I did have to spend a lot of Bitcoins along the way, like with legal fees and stuff. But yeah. I remember when I went in, I was telling myself that the amount of money that I have left to the value, it's like maybe $10,000 or $20,000, will be enough to like get me started when I get out and things like that. But I'll have to go back to work, get a real job, probably not in Bitcoin or crypto. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what I would do while I was inside. And for 2 years, my wife was the breadwinner of the family and had to send me money in prison to support me to pay for things, because not everything in prison is free. Like the basic level, like the shit expired food is, but if you want decent food, you have to pay for everything in jail. So but I was a little nervous that my life was following that bear and bull market, because I don't like the bear markets personally, because the first bear market was prison, right? Then the next bear market was the whole Winklevoss litigation. And that was like 10 months long, maybe even longer than that from like start to finish. So I was hoping that that was a sign of a bull market. But to me, around that time was actually maybe that bullish momentum, because from then till now, like the prices, I remember the price around that Winklevoss litigation, because I was thinking numbers in my head all the time. They were like 55,000 Bitcoin, 5,000 Bitcoin. And I'm like, how much? Every day that number is changing. Like one day it's like 46 million, and then it's like 87 million. I'm like, shit, you know, it's crazy. But so that when that ended, and I'm thinking, yeah, now we're ready to go for like a bull market. But in fact, I kind of look at that day as the day I got out of jail, right? But the price was double. But then the real bull market didn't happen for like a year and a half after I got out of jail. But I didn't realize that I was actually living in a bull market that whole time, because the litigation ended, I got married, you know, like we moved into a new house, like all these good life things that happened. We got our amazing dog, like just... I had personal developments with PTSD, like had been getting better. So like there were a lot of good things that were happening. And then, so now I'm hoping that we're about to go into that like real bull market. Like at this point, that's what I'm hoping for.
Thanks to our sponsor, Bitstamp, for making this special halving series possible. Bitstamp's the original global crypto exchange. We're proud to be celebrating their third Bitcoin halving. Doesn't get much more OG than that. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors worldwide, with over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. They've got some serious trading tech, matching engine from NASDAQ, the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. So you can join the 4 million traders on Bitstamp by downloading their app, the App Store or Google Play, or go to bitstamp.net/pro to get started. And a reminder for Bitstamp users, Messari is now offering 25% off of Messari Pro, our professional analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help identify your next investments using promo code Bitstamp. That's messari.io, offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve.
I think, I've always thought that one of the best services that could be offered in crypto, and I'm surprised we haven't seen anyone actually create this and follow through with it, is just a locked Bitcoin service where you decide to deposit funds and it is programmatically locked up for 5 years, right? So it's basically like a forced holding service.
Yeah.
And going to jail when you did was probably the closest that anyone in the industry has come to forced holding, because it would have been tough for you to access anything that was in cold storage or that had been socked away.
And they're collectible, like basically over the years, the coins that I've sold that I've never sold are the collectible coins that people have given me or I bought over the years, like the Cassatius coins and the stuff like that. Those Bitcoins have survived since 2011. So I tell people, you want to buy Bitcoin, you want to force yourself to hold it, buy like Bobby Lee's halving ballet wallet where it's like 12 Bitcoin, but the premium is going to be so large on that that you're never going to want to sell that. You're never going to want to redeem it. You know, like 20 or 30 of them ever made. You can't even buy it anymore, but a hardware wallet or whatever, things like that. Those have traditionally been the best ones for me. The problem with time lock is that the fear is with that, is that there could be like a rogue team down the road that could easily render those Bitcoins unspendable anymore. So by putting Bitcoin in smart contracts have been very like, you see a lot of pushback with smart contracts on Bitcoin for a lot of reasons, but one of them is for fungibility. The early the Bitcoin developers of today, like we can spend so much time talking about how shitty Bitcoin development is run. One of the few, there are very good things about it. And one of them is that the inability for Bitcoin to really change in a large way. And the Bitcoin developers and the Bitcoin developer community, because they're like people that work for free largely, and then ones have to work very, very hard for little to no money, like work 10, 12 hours a day. These people, of course, they're going to be passionate. Of course, they're going to be radical. There's still that anarchism, crypto anarchism, that like flowing in the undercurrents of, I feel like, the Bitcoin code still to today, and the undercurrents is still there. The business community is a lot less of that, but the development community and the miner community is still there because miners are the same way. They have to work for no pay. So you're seeing a lot of that, and you're seeing, because you're seeing like the crypto, the anarchist community, like still being a part of that undercurrent, all those narratives are still there. The smart contracts prevent those developers prevent any type of major changes. So going back to time locking your Bitcoin, the fear is that a rogue team of developers that would come, that would surpass these or take over, could eventually take those Bitcoin that are now in a category or in a contract, say, these are not spendable anymore or whatever. So basically making sure all Bitcoins are always fungible and they're all basically the same. I mean, you see people that don't even want to use the new type of BEX 32 addresses, the ones that start like BC1. People don't want to use those. And, you know, even there was a huge adoption for SegWit addresses that start with 3 because people were worried that they would make differences in types of Bitcoins. But no, that's not how Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is just your right to spend whatever is there, you know. That's another rabbit hole. I know, I go on tangents and digress, so I apologize.
I think valuable to hear the perspective because if you've held for any length of time through any number of cycles, except for buying Bitcoin in one of the 21 days or whatever it was, 6 weeks that we were above 10,000, basically any other time period that you're talking about, you'd be just fine. If you just held for a few years, forgot about it and leveraged one of these services or a Casasius coin or the like. I guess, you know, the other element here, we could talk about halvings, but really it's the kind of natural business cycle of crypto, whether it's halving sparked or not. You were kind of in the first wave, absent for the second, and now, you know, active in the industry again. You're public, but you're not necessarily active in terms of, you know, building companies. What are you excited about? Just personally and professionally, you know, within the Bitcoin realm or crypto more generally, if you've gotten bullish beyond just Bitcoin?
I made a subconscious decision to not be a public facing like CEO or to like launch my own company in Bitcoin, at least for the foreseeable future, until I felt that I had like a solid psychological and personal and financial like foundation. And also, I'm only 30. I have so much to learn. And when I was making those decisions, I still had a lot to learn. I still have so much more to learn. So I don't think I'm at the point that I should be even running a company and to be responsible for its employees at this point. Having said that, what I did do now, and it was actually a sign of the times, a lot of companies and people wanted to still work with me when I got out of prison, but they were afraid publicly to announce it. So what had happened was, is I started working for, and actually I still have some consulting and advisory clients since those years. And I've been working for privately some of the largest companies in the space, some companies that you probably have invested in, largely in mergers and acquisitions, M&A. I love the art of the deal. I love M&A. I love, because of my Rolodex, I brought together a lot of big deals that have been announced. I was a part of those You know, whether it was bringing those people together, being in those rooms, making the connections, formulating the ideas. I love doing that. And I love that because I'm in a fortunate position where I didn't need to, as a bull market happened, like worry about a paycheck every week or whatever. So I started with these projects, you can work for the success fee. And it almost gives you that adrenaline. That's how I joined the business community. I love doing that because it gives me the choice to do, but it also allows me to like maintain insight. So you're seeing, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, I feel like 2020, you're going to see a huge consolidation. And whether that is over the next few months, you see whether, you know, the price really has to double. What people don't realize is that miners, like the price has to continue to grow very quickly for miners to continue making the same amount of money that they made before. Every day that doesn't happen, if it takes a year for like the price to even double where it is now, if it takes us a year to get to 16,000, if we ever get there, whatever, you know, because like, nothing's ever a guarantee, you see a lot of people lose out. So do you think 2020 will be the year of consolidation? The insight that I have is the companies that I'm working with, I'll give you an example. One of the companies, I don't want to say which, top 10 company by you know, employees and revenue in our space. They actually finally, I don't took them so long, they set up a whole M&A like division. So that was like as of last month. So you're seeing that now. I was confused why it took people so long to do that. But what do you think? Do you think you'll see like the year of consolidation in 2020?
I think we've already started to see it. And part of that is driven by, you know, kind of the broader macro environment. Other teams, other, you know, entrepreneurs getting a little bit more risk averse, having, you know, more difficulty raising subsequent rounds. And, you know, the fact that the exchanges are the ones that have all the money and basically are either the primary employers or the primary customers for so much activity within the ecosystem. So I think, you know, I'm pretty sure that we're going to continue to see consolidation, but the lagging impact of a halving rally is usually this kind of trickle down wealth effect that benefits, you know, most new projects, most new entrepreneurs, and gives them a little bit more latitude so that they don't feel like they need to sell or you know, kind of join one of the big boys before, you know, they get their lunch eaten. So I'm looking forward to, you know, that part of the cycle because typically that's when we've seen some of the most exciting new companies emerge.
Yeah.
And then, get birthed. And then during the next kind of bear cycle, when we go from 150,000 and then Bitcoin crashes all the way down to 30, you know, that'll be a good sign that.
So you and I are like right now, you and I are doing is we're like doing the opposite of what we talked about. So we talk about how Bitcoin doesn't have these narratives and these cycles or whatever. It's more of like the product of. But here now we're talking about these different cycles and the era of and the year of, and it's largely my fault because I like using lingo. It's easier to talk. But here's
just to be clear, I've always thought that the industry moves in narrative cycles and the we're going to continue to see a number of bull and bear markets in Bitcoin is going to continue to be highly volatile.
Do you think that'll become more gray though in terms of the cycle periods? Like, for example, it used to be that, like we talked about, a lot of these companies were launched during the bear market, but all these companies that are hashtag DeFi, like BlockFi or whatever, they all launched in the past, I don't know, what, 9 months? Is the past not, what's considered a bear market? Are the last 6 months bear market? Like, what? When did bear market officially end? That's what I'm confused about.
Well, I think that those divisions only get obvious in hindsight.
Yeah, true story, actually. That's a good point.
So, where we are right now in the cycle, I think is a really important moment for Bitcoin and crypto more broadly, because you're seeing how it does in a recessionary environment for the first time.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the kind of international response has been to print as much money as possible and take these unprecedented intervention steps. So, you know, if not now, then when is kind of the mindset for Bitcoin. And that's totally outside of the halving. But the narrative plays very well because you know that the implied inflation rate of Bitcoin here on out is under 2%, which is under the long-term inflation target for the Fed and other, you know, central banks. And you know that there's, you know, a flight to hard assets, a flight to gold, a flight to property and real estate and other non-financial assets that is just starting to get underway and you know, will likely accelerate as the impact of some of these interventionist measures.
How much did the government print in 2008, '09, whatever? Do you remember? It was like 6 trillion. I forget.
No, it was much less than that. It was much less than that. It was a couple trillion between the, TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program was less. It was like 700 billion. And then the stimulus was another trillion or so.
Did you guys get a stimulus? I don't remember what had happened.
The deficit this year is going to be 4 trillion. And that's in addition to all of the, Fed easing and balance sheet expansion. So it's insane.
If we look at larger life cycles though, it's kind of crazy how we print all this money. 2009 Bitcoin launches, epic 10-year bull market. Now we just print another $2 trillion or whatever it is. Let's go for another 10-year epic bull market. Can we do that, Ryan?
Well, I'm not sure who, I think I've seen a couple people say some version of this, but you know, Bitcoin was born in the last recession. It will come of age during this recession and financial crisis. And I think there's some truth to that because the magnitude of what is happening right now in the financial system is an order of magnitude more stark than what we saw previously in the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah,
and the response has been proportionate in size. So, again, if not now, then when for Bitcoin halving or no? It just so happens that that this particular halving, I think, is going to have a pretty sizable impact from a narrative standpoint, given everything that's going on outside of just the Bitcoin bubble. Maybe one last question to riff on, Charlie. The one topic that's been brought up time and again with respect to the halvings is that it could potentially undermine the long-term security of Bitcoin. You know, you spent a lot of time with miners and you know that ecosystem pretty well. It's obviously changed considerably from having one when you could still mine on your GPU cores versus actually having to purchase ASICs. The second halving, it was kind of the industrial mining apparatus was already in place, but the margins were still very healthy for the larger players. Now it's kind of ruthlessly competitive at the margin, and it remains to be seen just how secure the network will be as the seniorage in the network declines and fees at some point, whether it's now or in a couple of years as inflation dips below 1%, at some point fees are going to have to pick up the slack. How have you thought about that, or have you thought about the mining apparatus and what the halving means for the network security in general? Or who have you talked to that have, you know, helped enlighten you or get you more knowledgeable about that dynamic?
It's a good question. And I spoke to different types of miners. I spoke to, you know, people like Bitfury and Slush, and then I would speak to who have been mining since, I don't know, longer than like me, like predate the charts, you know? And then you have the newer ones like Hut 8 Mining that work with, you know, the ones like Bitfury, and you have Hut 8, and then you have Canaan. I think you have so many of these different mining groups now, these mega, mega, mega companies around the world. Genesis I spoke to. And the difference is now a lot of them are preparing, so they can prepare for this in advance. They have different like revenue models. They almost like put the halving in their decks, you know, to raise capital to their investors. Like, look, we need money to continue operating or whatever. The narratives are definitely part. Miners need narrative. They need it. They need these narratives, I feel like, to continue growing. But I think about a lot of what you said, and it does scare me, because consolidation in the mining world is a fear, especially when you have a few different companies. So like a fear is, for example, you have a few different mining companies only, and these companies eventually create like an association and a working group. And then these mining organizations decide to create like a self-regulatory organization. And then the next step is like blacklists and basically coins and addresses that they don't want to accept. When that happens, Bitcoin's over. And the miners know that. So that'll prevent that from happening like in a blatant way. but it can't prevent, you know, miners or people or anyone from trying to undermine Bitcoin in like a much slower way. And so that's the fear. The other side of that was, I remember that there was a fear of this when GPUs. So at first it was like everyone was mining on their MacBooks and their Windows XP computers or whatever it was. And then it was, you could mine with your graphics cards. And then there's FPGA boards, and then it was ASICs. So I remember every time there was like an evolution of different type of efficiencies on minings, there was the whole centralization fear. If you look at the charts, not the charts of Bitcoin, but if you look at the hash rate charts, the snapshot charts, there were times that mining pools, and there still are, get 30-40% of the network hash rate. But that's okay for two reasons. One, it brings about efficiency. So you're bringing about, now all these miners are head to head with their margins. And dude, you and I are like, you know, we're huge capitalists. So we know that that monopolies are bad. The more companies, the better. Let them fight for margins, because they'll go and they'll do R&D and they'll create more efficient chips, more efficient computer systems that'll mine Bitcoin more efficiently, and it'll be more secure for Bitcoin. In fact, if it wasn't for Bitcoin miners, environmentalists, no one would really talk to them, because you Bitcoiners and Bitcoin miners, you know, are out there doing hydroelectric, that are building hydroelectric dams, that are putting for more efficiency and cleaner and renewable energy. These are the miners that are largely doing it. Now, I can't take all the credit, but the mining community is a largely part of it. So that's the first thing that I'm okay with. The second part is that, you know, when you have all these miners that are mining Bitcoin and they're validating transactions, most people don't realize that they're actually mining pools. And so what you saw with SegWit2x, one of the good things that came out of that was that miners that are mining on mining pools, and you look at Slush has 34% of, or whatever, of the mining hash rate, it's not that one person on his phone can push a button and control 34% of the hash rate. It's that pool is made up of maybe millions or tens of thousands of different miners around the world. And what came out of that SegWit2x thing was different pools now, F2 pool, Slush pool, whatever, took away their ability to vote on behalf of their miners. They don't want that responsibility. So now, you know, so out of these like fear and worries and these talks that you and I are talking about right now, miners are listening to your show. Business owners, CEOs are listening to your show. You know, they're listening to this right now. And you and I are like thought leaders in the space. I'm not saying that it's just because there aren't many thought leaders in the space. So you're going to have them listening. And now here it is. Here's the growth. Here's the change. Here's the efficiency. It's happening. It's happening now. It's going to continue happening. And it's happening because the shows like yours are happening and people are talking. And that's what we need. Talking, transparency, disclosures. We've talked about it so many times. It's so important. It's so important. It's the ethos of the blockchain, transparency.
Amen. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to end up. Charlie, where can people find you on the interwebs? You've been very active socially and done a lot of great stories on your own podcast.
Yeah.
But tell us where can people check that out and subscribe?
I'm the chief storyteller of untoldstories.com. Which is a podcast like yours, education and entertainment at the same time. They can follow me at Charlie Shrem on Twitter. And I always try to end off podcasts like this. I really try to answer. I do answer every email. I'm really good at it. I try to. Please don't write letters to my house. Please. Thank you. Have a great day. That's I just have to end the podcast off like that.
Excellent.
Well, the time for writing handwritten letters when I was in jail is over. I don't want them anymore.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep that in mind, and I will only pepper you with DMs. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Charlie. He's an OG and a wild man, and he's got a fantastic camouflage shirt for different components of this episode.
So I figured out what happened.
It's the palm trees.
The palm trees when I'm reflected on my shirt.
So we'll try to get the best clips with it going in and out, because there was some quite bedazzling sequences in here.
I'll talk to you later. Thank you.
Guys, if you want to check out the Bitcoin Halving series that we have, go to Messari.io. We have a Halving 2020 tab and resource center that's sponsored by Bitstamp. along with two research reports from our team, this conversation with Charlie, and the special series, which will also include conversations with Dan Matuszewski, former head of Circle Trade, Bobby Lee, former BTC China CEO, and Tor de Meester, one of the legendary Bitcoin analysts, and actually the first person that I ever saw speak about Bitcoin in Vegas in 2013. But until then, be good, stay safe, and thank you again to Charlie Shrem. Until next time, peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot if you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.